Il-program li ser tisimaw u għamidġu plilkom biex xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the program that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. It is my privilege today to have with me in the studio on University Matters the well-known British novelist Jim Crace. Just a few quick words about my guest. Jim Crace is the author of 12 novels, as well as a number of short stories and radio plays. His work has been translated into 28 languages. Prior to turning to writing novels as a full-time occupation, he worked as a freelance journalist for some of the top UK newspapers. Amongst his best-known works are the novels Continent, that was his first one, The Gift of Stones, Quarantine, Being Dead, The Pest House, and All That Follows, and his latest, which is forthcoming, called Harvest. Jim Crace is the recipient of several literary awards, among them the Whitbread Book Award, the Guardian Fiction Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Fiction Award, and his novel Quarantine was shortlisted for the Booker Prize for Fiction. I read on the British Council website that A.S. Byatt has described him as the most significant writer in English fiction of the last 10 years, which made me rather nervous about conducting this interview. In his usually rather brief novels, Jim Crace manages to invent fantastic worlds using almost journalistically succinct but very beautiful prose, and I hope we shall be discussing that aspect of his style during our chat. A very warm welcome to the programme.
Lovely to be here, of course.
Before chatting about your books, perhaps we could have a little look at Jim Crace the journalist, since that was where you started off from. I did a brief research, obviously, for this conversation, and I read a few of your media pieces, and I found them very satisfying. You were talking about, I don't know, Chernobyl and its effect on Snowdonia, or knotweed, an invasive plant, and the negative effect on the environment. And your love of deserts and your even greater love of beaches and seashores. Mm. What took you into journalism to start off with?
I think that as a working class boy from North London, weighed down, in fact brought up on the class system, because I come from a trade unionist, atheist, socialist background, I was only ever going to use what skill I had as a writer, as a storyteller, in something which was moralistically justifiable. And with that kind of background, writing poetry and writing fiction, that was kind of bourgeois. That wasn't something that a boy from my estate would aspire to. But politics was very respectable. In those working class environments, everyone talked politics. Everyone had a sticker in their window whenever there was an election. And certainly in our household we did. And so for those puritanical reasons, I think, once I realised I could write well, I wanted to write well in the service of humankind, in a way. I wanted to do good. I wanted to contribute to the debate about issues. And that's what journalism did. So that's really why I went into journalism.
And you certainly did fly around the world, didn't you?
I moved around the world, but, you know, I certainly did. I was lucky, I think, with journalism. But the luck was not really because I was a great journalist. I wasn't a great journalist. The luck was to do with the fact that I had the ability to invade a subject very quickly. So an editor could send me to investigate a country or to investigate a subject about which I knew nothing, and very quickly I would be able to gloss some information and look as if I was knowledgeable, which is quite a rare journalistic skill. But I was never going to be a great journalist. I was never going to be a journalist that made much of a reputation. I was a reliable, good jobbing journalist. I made a good living from top newspapers, but no one was ever going to remember me if I were to leave journalism.
Well, I was quite inspired by what I read of your journalistic pieces, but anyway.
I think you were lucky.
So let's talk about what took you out of it then, really. I mean, it wasn't simply because you didn't think you were going to be a famous journalist at the end of the day.
There was this background to me which was always a storyteller. the kind of thing which I could not allow myself to be when I was a journalist, because of this moralistic, puritanical background I have. I would never make anything up when I was writing an article for any newspaper. I wrote for what was basically the right-wing press, the Sunday Times and the Sunday Telegraph. And I was a socialist, of course, and still am. But I always felt that the facts themselves would be eloquent on the side of my cause, and that I should never invent anything and I should never make stuff up. But by nature, I'm a kind of a liar. As a kid, I was always telling stories. I was always fibbing. I would never recount an anecdote without an extra 90% of exaggeration to make it more entertaining. And so that part of me was repressed by being a journalist. But I never thought that I would turn it into being a successful writer of fiction, because my knowledge of fiction was that you wrote a book and that your cousins bought it and no one else. Of course, if you're a Catholic, you had more cousins than anyone else, but otherwise you didn't make a profit. However, I was sort of forced into it, because when I started writing for the Murdoch Press, for the Sunday Times, I found that my articles were being politically interfered with. And there was one particular article which I wrote about riots in North London, in which a policeman, Colin Blakelock, had been murdered, and a black American, a black English woman, had also been killed in the Broadwater Farm riots. And I wrote an article about that a year on, and the article turned out to be quite anti-police, and justifiably so, I have to say, and the editor refused to publish it. And I was faced with one of those crises that, do I stand by principle or do I just shrug my shoulders and accept it? And at the time, I just started writing Continent, and I'd had an advance paid on this collection of short stories, come novel, whatever it is. And I had American money. And I think there's no excuse for not being principled when you can afford to be principled. So I left journalism and took up writing fiction full-time.
What do you feel that you took with you, however? Do you feel that you've taken a journalistic style into your novel writing?
Well, I took discipline into novel writing, because publishers tend to say, oh, take your time, old chap, we're in no hurry, and they don't, you know, they pay you some money, and if they wait 3 years, they seem to be quite content to wait 3 years for your novel. But of course, that didn't apply in fiction, in journalism. The editor would say, I want it by Tuesday, and if it wasn't there by Tuesday, they wouldn't re-employ you. And so the business of being terrified of the blank page and never getting on with things, sitting around humming and haring and waiting for the muse to come to your side, never applied to me. By the time I started writing fiction, I'd got the habit of being efficient and not wasting time and sitting down early in the morning and getting on with it and stop making a fuss and don't expect people to allow you to be lazy. So that has been a great help. The result was that, of course, that I had a very workmanlike attitude towards writing fiction. And to this day, I have never worked at a weekend, and I've never worked in the evening. I work office hours, which I think it sounds rather dull. So that's one thing I took from it. And the other thing that I took from it was that if you're a journalist, they might say, we want 1,400 words. And you turn in 1,550 words. So 150 have got to go. And the first 150 that are going to go is the best parts of your writing. They're your best adjectives or the little joke you've made, because they're not essential to fact. So I learned very quickly to stick to the number of words and to make every sentence that you write absolutely freighted with information and with adjectives and with the jokes, so that they couldn't be taken out. So that's one thing I think that perhaps... I'm not hoping to sound boastful, but objectively I can say about my prose, is that every sentence is loaded with effect.
The literature that you have sort of produced really has been likened to the literature of Calvino and Nabokov and Kafka, because you treat your subjects with this magic realism. Yeah. You've said that you couldn't write in the social realist mode because you're a happy person. You feel that poets need to be sad people or something like that to be able to produce some. But I think it goes beyond that. There must be something about that sort of grand narrative that grabs you, that makes you want to speak on that level.
Well, the autobiographical side of things that you mentioned, I'll talk about that first. And that is that if I were to write an autobiographically based novel, it would be the most boring novel in the world for the reasons that I've said earlier. You know, then that phrase, happiness writes white. I don't want to sound glib, but I have had a very happy life and I've had, one marriage and we're lucky with our children. That does not make a good novel. Literature doesn't like success stories. Literature likes death more than life. It likes ill health rather than good health. It prefers divorce to long marriages. It prefers illness to fitness and all such things. Not because fiction and narrative is negative-minded or is pessimistic, but because its purpose is there to prepare you for the dark side of the world which lays ahead of all of us in one form or another. So I couldn't naturally be an autobiographical writer because I didn't have those experiences. But anyway, I had a natural feeling for the exaggerated version of the world rather than the journalistic mirror image of the world. When I was a journalist, what I would do would be to hold a mirror up to a real world. And that's what the more realist novelists do. So if a realist novelist sets a novel in Malta, for example, that novelist would owe a duty to this real place, Malta, that anyone that knows it would say, yes, I've been there, it looks like that, it smells like that, it tastes like that. You can't play games with real places. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to comfortably locate my readers in a place they recognised, although I know that's a great skill. I wanted to dislocate my readers. I wanted my readers to feel uncomfortable. I wanted them to encounter places that don't exist, that weren't mirror images. They were smoky images, really. And that's what magic realism does. And that actually is what happens in most fiction that existed, say, before Jane Austen. You think of the folklore stories of Greece, the legends of Greece, or the Icelandic legends, or the monkey stories of Nigeria. They're not about real mirrored universes. They're actually about imagined landscapes. There's no such thing as the Minotaur. It didn't exist. And that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to describe exactly the cow. I wanted to invent the Minotaur.
I'd very much like you, if you can, to do us the honour of reading a paragraph, which I've picked out from The Gift of Stones, because I think that, yes, we've said that you write in succinct language, but it is certainly poetic. And I find these couple of paragraphs, and there are many of them, I just picked this one because I liked it. Here in Malta, we don't know much about our change from the fabulous Neolithic to our bronze, so I found the story engaging. Perhaps we could hear something from that.
So, 7, 8 years on, I was beyond the bowman's age. It was the end of summer, and there you see me once again upon the shore, running toes along the sand. I was well. I had no colds. My throat was clear. My lips were soft. For once, the wind and sea were tame. The wrack was almost dry. The birds were grazing on the beach like sheep. There were no living scallops at my feet, just empty valves, the fluted valleys of their 15 ribs turned green and black with sea crust. I could invent for you a sea and wind and sky that flung salt weed in my face and emptied water from the pools and cast a light so dark and feeble that even lugworms took the day for night, mistook the wind for tide, and coiled their ropes too soon upon the sand. But I will keep it calm and windless. The sight was no less strange. I skimmed a scallop out to sea, and there, as unself-conscious as a cloud, a ship was passing by. What would you do if you were me? Run back and tell the Stonies? What? That they should arm themselves and gather on the shore? That they should hurry from their workshops, the stones left baking, the bellows breathless in the hearth, and prepare themselves for trade with sailors? That they should simply stand in awe like me and witness from the land the recklessness of travel on the sea? They tell me, scram,
We've work to do. They'd call me little liar. And for sure, if one or two were tempted to take the bracken path towards the sea to prove me false, they couldn't reach the cliffs in time. For all the stillness on the beach, the muscles in the clothing of the sail made clear enough to me that there were breezes just offshore. That ship would soon be out of sight. Unless, of course, I followed it. Why shouldn't I? I had no stones. I simply filled my chest with air and took off down the coast.
Thank you very much for reading that extract.
Can I just say, by way of excuse or perhaps explanation, is that you will have heard in that reading, I hope, if I read it properly, that there are lots of rhythms going on there. The prose is very musical. And that's one of the things that the critics in England perhaps hate about my books. One of the critics famously said that to read a single paragraph of a Jim Crace book is to invite a migraine, because it's almost as if there's so much timpani going on and so much percussive music going on in my prose that it's going to give you a headache. But my defence of that is that I write formally, but in the oral tradition. And if you were an oral storyteller, which after all in human histories would have been the norm rather than the written version of things, if you're an oral storyteller, you just have to use every trick in the book in order to keep your audience's attention, because they're going to drift off. There's going to be a baby crying. You know, someone is not going to be paying attention. And you would use your hands and you'd use your eyes, but you'd also modulate the type of sentences you're using. You'd wake people up with the drumbeat of a particular word, and you would then schmooze them with the melody of another sentence. And it seems to me it's a great pity that the realist tradition of fiction has lost that melodic musical sound, and I'm perhaps on my own in trying to keep it going.
The musicality of it definitely comes across. There are some themes in The Gift of Stones which are themes that come up throughout your work. For example, that truth, obviously it's a big theme. You said that when you were young you used to like to
use the word lie. Yes, you can say that, that's okay, yeah.
About your stories. Do you feel that this is a sort of leitmotif that runs through your work?
Yeah, I think that if you work with fiction, then you've got to believe that it has power. And the power that I've come to recognise it has, after all, for good Darwinist reasons, here we are amongst the 9 million different species of creatures that there are in the world, although they're finding new beetles in Brazil as we speak. We are the only one with this highly developed sense of narrative. And it goes alongside with humankind, this highly developed consciousness which we have as an animal. Now, Darwinist theory, which I clearly approve, would say that unless narrative conferred upon us a huge advantage, it would have died out. And I think we've already touched on this earlier, that narrative prepares us for the dark side of humankind. It does all sorts of useful things. And so if narrative and constantly in our mind's eye reinventing the past or imagining the future, which is what we do all day, we imagine what we're going to say to our husband or wife when we get home to recount the argument we've had, what we might be doing next week if we're going on holiday. We use our imaginations narratively all the time. So if it's going to be that important in our lives, I don't want people to believe that narrative is only important in fiction. So this is something that I think my books do. This is why my books sort of glorify lying, and they glorify exaggeration, and they glorify storytelling. And it's because, forget novels, forget books, the last person you want to meet in a pub and have a conversation with is the person that doesn't have a narrative spirit, that can't exaggerate, that doesn't embroider their sentences, that doesn't push the truth a little bit too far. So my stories, I suppose, are a glorification of the lie.
This wonderful idea of storytelling, which you've touched on when you're saying that your prose has this sort of lyrical aspect to it, and this idea of stories coming out of the clashing of two worlds, the new, where you're making sense of the new while making a memory of the past, which comes out very strongly in this particular book. The glory of storytelling, how it sort of explains our life to us. And this is another theme which comes out throughout your books.
Well, I'm interested in the clash of the new and the old. I like the cusps of the end of one epoch and the development of the new. You know, the end of the Stone Age, the beginning of the Bronze Age. But of course, that book wasn't actually about that particular thing. The Gift of Stones is more a product of my hometown of Birmingham, where the Industrial Age was ending, and a post-industrial age was starting. And my question to myself in this book was, how does a community that had taken all of its self-esteem from the nobility of labour, and there's a lot of nobility about labour, how does it reinvent itself when labour is removed? So all of my books have those modern themes.
You have been accused of being very graphic. Sometimes there's a bit of a cruelty in what you write.
Yeah.
And you know, the darkest bits, say, of your writing, which come across in Quarantine. But listening to some of your interviews with various journalists, the subject of optimism crops up quite regularly, sort of coping with life, the big questions about life. In your case, looking at it from an atheist standpoint as well, you said you started off that book thinking it was going to be a put down for the Christian story, really. But it actually has gone beyond that and has resonated perhaps as a book of optimism, much perhaps to your surprise.
Well, you start a book with the brain in charge, coming up with a few ideas you want to talk about, but the heart takes over. So your innate self bubbles through very often, or your state of mind while you're writing a book. And it's hard to resist that. But books have views of their own. Now, I'm not trying to be new agey and spooky when I say that, but if narrative, here we go on the same old story again, but if narrative is ancient, as it is, as ancient as humankind, then it will have learned a trick or two, and it will have become wise, and it will have become mischievous, and all of those things. So one of the things that you do as a writer, and you hope for as a writer, is not that you are in charge of the whole time. You hope that at some point, that great heavy boulder that you're pushing up a hill when you're writing a novel turns into a light balloon. And the lightness comes from the fact that narrative comes to your aid, it comes to your shoulder, and starts to make suggestions of its own. And so with a book such as Quarantine, you start off with a Marxist, atheist attitude, but the narrative doesn't want you to do that. The narrative wants you to suggest other things, and the narrative is more sweet-minded than you are. And that's the joy of writing, to see this, the nature of the story of itself taking over from the craft that you're putting into it. And that's why, you know, this lonely profession, it can be enjoyable.
I was fascinated by your approach, your political activism, mixed with a distaste for people who are not prepared to be political, because, you know, that does come across in your writing. Mm. You seem to fit more the French intellectual model, where thinking and being an intellectual are considered more of a norm, whereas in England the English tend to be a bit cagey about anybody who's suggesting that they're sort of slightly intellectual. You seem more, I would put you more at home in a cafe in Paris talking to people than I would in a pub in Enfield.
Well, there you go. You can't trust, you can't presume to see the image of the writer through the books that they write. And people have wrongly imagined, made several mistakes about me. One is that they read my books and think that that when they meet me, I'm going to be like death, you know, with grey hair down to my shoulder and a great scythe of misery. I mean, you know, people have approached me at festivals, not having met me before, with fear on their faces. I wouldn't have a sense of humour, and indeed that I'm not English. And on more than one occasion, Continent came out, I went to a festival and they were expecting a black writer because it felt like a third world book. And very often I'm being, my surname is being mispronounced. In fact, not so long ago, I was in a bookshop in New York and had to buy a copy of one of my own books for reasons I won't go into. And I said to the shop assistant, have you got Being Dead by Jim Crace? I had to read from it that afternoon, and he didn't even look at me. He said, Crace. And I said, I beg your pardon. He said, it's pronounced Crace. Well, I couldn't.
Did you disabuse him?
Well, I didn't disabuse him. It was one of those Woody Allen moments that I should have said something, but I felt would have felt so foolish and cheesy to say anything. So that often happens because people do believe that I'm not English. And I think the reason for that is that in England there's a kind of an anti-intellectual tradition. Now, I'm not making myself out for being intellectual because I'm not an intellectual. But for example, if you get together a group of British writers at a lunch table, which has happened to me in the past, because there used to be a group of writers with myself, David Lodge, and various others from the Midlands who'd meet regularly. If anybody was serious at that dinner table for more than a few minutes, everyone else would get comfortable and break up the faux pas that you were making by being serious, by cracking a joke. Exactly the opposite would happen in France or Italy or anywhere else more civilised than England. If someone was being serious and you interrupted with a joke, that would be the faux pas. That would be the thing that was considered unacceptable. And so I'm very comfortable in those jokey environments, but my books are not like that. My books are unembarrassedly serious. They would not make good dining companions. If you read one of my books to an English audience, they'd want to interrupt with jokes really quite soon. And it's not because I've got a dark view of the world, and it's not because that there's any cruelty in me. It's just because my particular kind of optimism, I feel, has to visit dark places in order to achieve the optimism. What point is optimism about? You know, the optimistic view of the of heaven, for example, which says an optimistic view of death, which says we die and we go to heaven and we're surrounded by angels and harp music. Well, that's too easily achieved. That's too readily described. It doesn't visit any dark places. It doesn't face up to any of the realities of death in order to find its optimism. But that's what my books do, and they do horrify a lot of people. I get abused for my pessimism, and I get abused for my cruelty at readings.
I can assure listeners that you don't have long white hair and you're not carrying it.
Short white hair.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time.
Thank you, Patricia.
And in a newspaper article in 2007, you wrote that Defoe's Robinson Crusoe served and nurtured your innate and lifelong love of islands, mm-hmm. the seashore, and especially flotsam. I'm not sure you're going to have much time to walk along beaches looking for flotsam today during your visit, but I do hope that you enjoy your stay on this island just the same. So, Jim Crace, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqat tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.